from the Bhagavatam, or should we just speak about Bhakti Vinod Thakur? You're our host. Why don't you decide? Today's the appearance day of Bhakti Vinod Thakur. Should I read from Srimad Bhagavatam? Should I just speak about Bhakti Vinod Thakur, or a little of both?
Well,
a little of both. Okay. I've been reading from first canto in a consecutive way. And first canto chapter 10. Chapter 10 is Krishna's just on his way out of Hastinapur returning to Dwarka. So the previous chapters 7 is Ashwatthama tries to kill the child within the womb of Uttara, Maharaj Parikshit. Later, the five sleeping sons of the Pandavas, who he's going to strike to kill. So, then, the Krishna's preparing to be, Uttara stops him to protect the embryo in the womb. Kunti stops him, offers very, very beautiful prayers. In chapter 8, Maharaj Yudhisthira requests Krishna to remain for some time longer. So Krishna remains. The passing of Grandfather Bhishma is chapter 9. Wonderful instructions by Grandfather Bhishma to Maharaj Yudhisthira. And in chapter 10, Maharaj Yudhisthira has become his rule. It describes how abundant everything was being supplied by nature because of the piety and the submission of Maharaj Yudhisthira unto Krishna. Everything was flourishing. And everything is so nice, except that Krishna's not going to leave. And the description, viraha, the affection of the Pandavas and all the royal family and all the brahmanas and the ladies of Hastinapur, in different ways have been described as their feeling enormous pang of separation from Krishna. I think he's asking the person to go to Dwarka. So the section of meeting is now as he's actually leaving the palace, going through the streets of Hastinapur, the ladies are up on rooftops. And they had never seen Krishna before. They heard of Krishna, like with me. They heard of Krishna. And now they were seeing him with their eyes. And their hearts were very moved with that ecstasy of being in Krishna's presence. And they were describing him not in the choice poetry of the Samaveda, that as far as Krishna was concerned, even more appealing for two reasons. was very direct. Sometimes glorifications of the Supreme and the Vedas, they're indirect, just like the discussion last night about Brahman. Brahman, or just like the light of the day, indicates the sun is up. Although we can't see the sun directly, we can see the light of the day. So now the sun is up. But like that, the Vedas indirectly refer to the presence of the Supreme through the effulgence of the Supreme. But the words of the ladies of Hastinapur, this is Vyasadeva describing, was more pleasing than the Vedas, because it was very direct. Direct appreciation and glorification. And more pleasing because it was with such feeling of love. And these aren't just, you know, emotional, sentimental ladies. They're not scholars, but they have a very deep understanding of who Krishna is. And so, yesterday was discussing the first of their prayers, where they're describing Krishna's position as the source of the entire cosmic manifestation, which he supports and maintains for some time, which draws those living entities as well as all forms of matter within his body, and holds them there until the next period of creation, and that same being is standing before them right now. I mean, imagine if you had that, the realization of the root of all existence, and there he is standing before you. They're overwhelmed. One of the points that Prabhupada is making is, since he's the source of matter, then what does that mean about his body? His body is not material. And since his body is not material, he's appearing before them as if he's in a human-like form. But they have the understanding his body is not material. And therefore his activities are not material. And there's nothing about him that's material. Because how can something material produce all spirit and all matter? Not the case. And they explicitly state also, you exist before all of this comes into being. All forms of matter and all living entities being expanded. That's the first of their prayers to Krishna. The second one is, the personality of Godhead, again, desiring to give names and forms to his parts and parcels, the living entities, place them under the guidance of material nature, by his own potency. Material nature is empowered to recreate. Well, they're saying lots of things. I'll read the purport, but the matter doesn't move without the touch of spirit. Matter can't create, but we're discussing. Vedic conception is very clear, and practical experience is also very clear. Both. That, take any very sophisticated machine, airplane, or a computer, or a car, or, you know, your blender, or, you know, something that's a sophisticated machine. It does very sophisticated operations, but it doesn't move without an operator. So you have a plane sitting there for, you know, a robot. that does very sophisticated human-like things. They designed a robot that can play chess. You know, this move and then that move and then that move and that move, and they can play chess. They can do all kinds of robotics. It's a very sophisticated field of technology. But the robot doesn't move without a person, the operator of the machine. So matter doesn't move without the touch of spirit. And as it's so in a micro, it's also in a macro scale. So, although there's simple ladies not educated like the brahmanas who are offering beautiful prayers to Krishna as he is leaving, they're offering other kinds of prayers, very simple. But their understanding is that the power of matter to apparently create is because of your contacts with that matter. Like when the soul leaves the body, what happens? The activity of the body certainly stops, and even the integration of the components of the body stops. It disintegrates. The animating factor, the cohesion factor, is the soul. Or to speak of the Supreme Soul. The entirety of creation is dependent upon the personality of Godhead. So by his own potency, material nature is empowered. With the touch of spirit, matter can do things. And specifically, the word is used to recreate, but because Sisikshatim, because the business of creation is, every time there's creation, we can know that before that there's a prior creation. It's cyclical. There's Prabhupada's good point. The living entities are parts and parcels of the Lord. They are of two varieties, namely Nitya Mukta and Nitya Bhadra. Nitya Mukta are eternally liberated souls, and are eternally engaged in reciprocal transcendental living service with the Lord in his eternal abode beyond the mundane manifested creation. But the Nitya Bhadra, or eternally conditioned souls, are entrusted to his external energy, Maya, for rectification of the rebellious attitude toward their Supreme Father. Nitya Bhadras are eternally forgetful of their relation with the Lord as parts and parcels. They are bewildered by the illusory energy as products of matter, and thus they are very busy making plans in the material world for becoming happy. They go on merrily with plans, but the will of the Lord, by the will of the Lord, both the plan makers and the plans are annihilated at the end of a certain period, as above mentioned. So the above mentioned is that there's the creation, maintenance for some time, period of manifestation is over, everything's withdrawn. They can't say, wait a minute, I got my plan. Prabhupada told the story of a friend of his when he was grihastha. Very well, was diagnosed having a terminal disease, and the doctor told him, my dear sir, you have, you know, 4 months to live. And he said, doctor, I have so much money, I give you so much money, just give me 2 years. The doctor can't live 2 years. He can't extend beyond 1 moment. Whatever the indication of the Lord is. So after a certain period, withdrawal, and the there's two annihilations, a partial and a complete annihilation. The partial annihilation takes place at the end of the day of Brahma. And the complete annihilation takes place at the end of the life of Brahma. At the end of the day of Brahma comes his night, and what happens is, up to Svarga Loka and everything below, all the planets and all the living entities, they're dissolved. And the dissolving process is very interesting. Drought for 100 years throughout the whole universe, then fire. Raging fire, so everything becomes ash, and then a flood. Everything just dissolved like alcohol also. So the dissolved ingredients are then withdrawn within the body of Vishnu. And when the night of Brahma is over, they then come out. And Brahma has to take all those ingredients and all the living entities and match them up and create the lower planets and up to Svarga Loka. And then at night, same thing happens, everything is withdrawn within the body of Vishnu, only this is the entire everything, even above Svarga Loka, the four planetary systems. Janaloka, Mahaloka, Takaloka, and Brahmaloka. They're also dissolved. In fact, the whole, even the coverings of the universe are dissolved. The whole thing is avyakta, unmanifest. And then again, that's one exhalation of the Lord. And then, when he again exhales, and that's another creation of the universe. So everything's going on layers of cycles and smaller cycles and bigger cycles. It's all cyclical. So the living entities are again provided with bodies. The term that's used here is sapotita nyaya. Nyaya means logic. So sapotita, the logic of susupti. There are three stages of consciousness according to the Vedic wisdom. There's wake, asleep, and deep sleep. Deep sleep is like when you're under anesthesia. It's not like asleep. It's when they can perform operations because you're conscious. Living entity is still conscious, but consciousness is in this susupti stage. And then when you come out of that anesthesia, then it comes to the awake state. But if you pass through the dreaming, sleeping state first, and then awake. And when you wake, what do? Oh, I'm Mr. So-and-so, I have to go take care of my business, my family, or whatever it is that one does. So, the logic, the idea of deep sleep is what happens at the time of cosmic annihilation and then again creation. So what happens when creation is again established? Brahma understands the karma of the living entity, and so he fashions bodies according to their karma. In fact, it happens from lifetime to lifetime. According to our karma, we're awarded a particular body. This is discussed in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Purusha prakriti stoghi bhunte prakriti jan gunan karanam gunasam dosyasa yoni janmasu. According to the bhunte, or the inclination for enjoying matter, living entity is awarded a body. So, put in simple language, Prabhupada explains, if somebody in this life misuses the human form of life, because the human form of life is awarded for self-realization. It's like, you know, you get an iPod, and inside the box is the iPod, but it's also the operations manual. But supposing somebody doesn't know what an iPod is for, and they want to crack walnuts with it. The RAM is the iPod, it's not what it's for. It's for a certain thing, and the operator's manual says what it's for. So the operator's manual for this human form of life is self-realization. Here's how you use this human form of life, and you can achieve self-realization and God-realization. That's what it's meant for. And if people receive this human form of life and use it in the wrong way, then, according to their disposition for enjoyment, then they have a corresponding body. If they live their life in a doggish way, they get a dog body. And so forth. Indiscriminately eating anything and everything, can become a hog. Or whatever the outcome is. So bodies are fashioned according to guna and karma. Chatur Bhana Maharaj Vishnam Guna Karma Vidagasham. Krishna says he creates the system whereby, according to guna and karma, we're awarded the body. And then with each body, there's an operations manual. There's a set of duties that we have to perform, given our guna and karma, our psychophysical nature. So what the ladies are describing is how Krishna sets all that system up. It's by his potency that this all happens. The Nitya brothers are bewildered by the illusory energy as products of matter. They think themselves to be products of matter. If we think, like in the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes the divine and demoniac, sura and asura. The asura bhav thinks life is nothing but a combination of male and female. There's nothing more to it than that. Just mixing of emulsifications and you get life. There's nothing more than that. There's no spirit or soul involved. And so if life is just a bag of chemicals, it's quite expendable. The maniac mentality thinks that way. What's the purpose of all that? Why did he do that? purpose.
Appa.
The purpose of creation has two whole purposes. One is living entities that are rebellious, they're averse to God's position as supreme. They're likened to criminals. They're in the state, and they say, I don't care for the laws of the state. I'm going to do what I want. So there are places created for such rebellious people to live. It's called a prison. They're not killed, because souls, you can't kill souls. The soul is carrying on, but they're given a residence. This material world is created as a residence for rebellious souls who desire enjoyment apart from Krishna in a lawless way. So they're given a place to try to do that. It's unpleasant. It's not happy. There's a place of confinement and rectification. The rectification part is to give us an opportunity, at least in this human form of life, to get the opportunity to restore our original, obedient, loving nature as the purpose. So when the suffering comes, it's like if a child misbehaves, the mother may say, and then the child goes, oh, it's for a good reason. Don't take that broken glass. Don't. The experiences of suffering have a lesson behind them. You want enjoyment and you're getting suffering. What's wrong here? It's not the design is wrong, it's we're misapplying this human form of life in suffering. And when we misapply the human form of life, we bring suffering to all varieties of living entities, not just human forms of life. But properly applying human intelligence, then it's beneficial for ourselves and beneficial for all the forms of life, if we live our life that way. Says in Bhagavad Gita, this created world and material energy are under my control. Under the influence of Prakriti, automatically they are created again and again, and this is done by me through the agency of my external energy. It goes on. I can read the whole report. But the realm of illusion is one of Krishna's energies. It's his Bahiranga Shakti, it's his external energy. There's another realm that's created by Krishna's energy, and that's the spiritual realm. It's his Antaranga Shakti. And then there's the living entity that's Tatastha Shakti, it's marginal. Marginal, the word Tatastha is described in the Vedas this way, very nice, very easy to understand. Where marginal katastha means where there's a river and then the river bank and one side is water and the other side is land and the dividing place between the water and the land is katastha. So that little line that's not land and it's not water, it's katastha. The living entity is Tatastha, where in between this position of the spiritual energy and the material energy of the Lord, and depending upon our free will, specifically depending upon our regard for the Supreme, our relationship with God, we're placed under the care of the internal or the external potency. And what the ladies of Hastinapura describing as Krishna. Krishna, as you are grieving, we're appreciating who you really are. You're not just a relative or a great king of Dwarka. You're the original personality of Godhead, who by its potency animates the entire cosmic manifestation, not just, you know, our home here in Hastinapur, or our city in Hastinapur, or the stage, or the planet, but the whole universe. Your potency is such that you animate material nature to bring about all the different manifestations and features of creation. How powerful you are. And there you are, riding on the chariot, going to Dwarka. So that just happens to be where I am in my consecutive reading of the Bhagavatam. Because this is the appearance day of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I'll say something about Bhaktivinoda Thakur. There's a picture of Srila Prabhupada, our founder Acharya, and his spiritual master was Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was the son of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. In the year that Srila Prabhupada was born, that was 1896, so he came to America in 1966, so that means he was 70 years old when he came. And that very same year, 1896, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, from his position as the chief magistrate in Puri under the British government, he was at that time very active thinking, just to give you an idea of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's vision and capacity. He wanted the whole world to know who was Lord Chaitanya. Even in India, how many people know who was Lord Chaitanya? You know, before the association with ISKCON, how many of you knew Lord Chaitanya? And I certainly didn't know Lord Chaitanya. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur's vision was the whole world should know. And so he wrote a book called Life and Precepts of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It was about this thick, like 86 pages. Very, very old, the old offset. The page was about this big. And, offset print means, the letters weren't even in straight rows. And very old Indian paper, but I had a copy of that original book. And it's taken from Chaitanya Charitamrita, because there's who is Lord Chaitanya, and then what did he teach? There's sections of Chaitanya Charitamrita, those teachings are presented, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur summarized his teachings. And he sent them out to universities all over the world, because he felt at least the scholars should know. And sometime later, that was 1896, sometime later, when Prabhupada came to the West, one devotee in McGill University in Toronto, and another devotee in Southeast Asia somewhere, in Manila or the Philippines or something like that, found a copy in the library at the university. The original book that Bhaktivinoda Thakur sent. And they were very excited and showed it to Prabhupada, and he was so happy. Just see the vision. At a time when nobody knew of Lord Chaitanya, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was thinking the world should know. And what his teachings of pure devotion are. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was born in the early 1900s in an aristocratic family in Calcutta. He was educated with the Tagore family. He went to the best of schools and rubbed shoulders with the elite intellectuals of his time. There's some highlights of his life because his biography is quite large. There's a lot known about his life. From childhood, he showed an inclination for writing. When he was just a teenager, he wrote his first book. It was a ballad that was in prose, not poetic neither, like the Iliad and the Odyssey kind of thing. It was a quest, a searching young man looking for the fulfillment of his ideals, and searching for truth was the theme of the poem. He learned as a young man about printing, and so he was very involved throughout his life in writing books. In the course of his life, he wrote, and you know, this is a university, so you have to do sometimes some papers. How long does it take to write a paper? What do you speak of a book? He wrote 120 books. And they were, with the range of those books, went from written in Sanskrit, where it was like Tattva Viveka is one, where it's explaining in little sutra-like expressions the message of the Vedas, you know, by theme, by topic, and just in pure Sanskrit. And then he wrote a commentary on it so it could be understood. And where on the other end, he wrote songs in simple Bengali language so that the teachings of Lord Chaitanya could be understood by people who couldn't read. So they could sing a song. And by singing the song, they would learn the song, and by learning the song, they would learn what the teachings of Lord Chaitanya were. He wrote fiction, but in the fiction, like a very large book and a very popular book, was Jaiva Dharma. That's in the top explain, but the great literature of any culture is actually something from scripture put in contemporary form so the people of the time could understand and relate to it. He gave the example of Paradise Lost and Paradise Gained by John Milton from England. So it's what it is a contemporary rendering of what the Bible says of Paradise Lost, the fall of Adam and Eve, and Paradise Regained, returning to it. So, and literally, really even the Odyssey is that kind of a literature. So for the Greek, so what he did was, he took the message of Lord Chaitanya and framed it in a contemporary story. The story was two young men from Calcutta. They had some vacation from school, so they decided, oh, let's go to this place called Navadvip, and they went to Navadvip, and much to their surprise, they found, you know, amazing, saintly people there, and they thought, wow, this is interesting. And then they asked some questions, and then they went back, as, you know, this unit home. The modern scene of growing up in Calcutta at the time and going to college and what that life was like. And then they were curious, so they went back, and you know, each chapter they go back and they get another lesson of Lord Chaitanya's teachings. It just takes you through the whole chapter by chapter. Bhakti Rasana to Sindhu by Rupa Goswami, and another section is the 10 essential teachings of Lord Chaitanya, chapter by chapter. And then, you know, in the drama, the parents get concerned, oh, they're getting too religious, we better get them married. And so, they have all this decision of what are we going to do? Should we get married? And we go to the sadhu in Navadvip, and he explains why he feels they should get married. Although they were enunciates. It's difficult to maintain enunciation, and you should say, he gives their reasons. It's contemporary, it's fiction, that is just explaining teachings in a palatable, interesting form so that the public would read it. Or commentaries on Bhagavad Gita and commentaries on the Bhagavatam and commentaries, and then he published the writings of previous acharyas. He translated them from Sanskrit into Bengali and into English and published them. Many, 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 many wonderful books on how to perform bhajan properly, bhajana rahasya, very, very deep, detailed description of how to do your devotional sadhana practices. Vast range. So when he completed his college education, because of his father had died, so there were some relatives that were looking after him, and the relatives were all aristocratic, and so they gave him a high position and a manager of some business factory or something. And the first thing he did was he was going through the accounts and he saw that there was a mistake in the favor of the company, but against one of the customers. So he went to the customers and said, we overcharged you. There's your money back. And then the owner saw what he had done and said, I think you have the wrong profession. You should become a teacher or something like that, because you don't do it, you just do it in business. You give money back. You should have another job. So, he did become a teacher for a while, and after some time, because he had some further law education, he became a lawyer, and gradually through the whole, whatever system of things, of promotion to the British government, they promoted him to a high court judge, which during the time wasn't that. High court judges are British. But because he was so good, and that gave confidence to the people that they were being dealt with fairly, they made him a high court judge. And they made him a high court judge in Puri. And when he was placed in Puri, he was also, as the high court judge, put in charge of the temple, the affairs of the Jagannath temple. One of the first things he did in the Jagannath temple was there was supposed to be, that traditionally there was a certain number of offerings a day, something like 36 offerings a day. The arrangement was something was placed before the Jagannath and offered in the clay pots in which they were cooked. And after the offering was completed, those pots removed and another set of pots were placed. And they had like 18 different kitchens and Jagannath Puri temple, and that standard had gone down. The first thing he did was he placed that standard again. So many nice things to describe. One of them was that there was this was before Puri. There was a place where he was a judge, and the people in the village were known to go to worship a tree, because it was said there was a ghost in the tree, and they would make offerings to the ghost so he would not cause them problem and give them special favors, and they were worshiping the ghost in the tree. And it was a big disturbance for the people of the village, because the regular worship was being neglected. Instead, they're worshiping a ghost on the tree. So what Bhaktivinoda Thakur did was he had some of his own money. He went to a brahmana and offered, said, I'm a householder. It's my duty as a householder to give charity to a brahmana. So I'd like to give charity to you. But I would like some rabbinical service from you also. Could you take Srimad Bhagavatam and sit under the tree and just read Srimad Bhagavatam for 4 or 5 hours a day. Just read it aloud. I'll happily give you some contribution. And the Brahmana did that. He read the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, literally on the last day when he completed the Srimad Bhagavatam, the ghost left the tree. A branch towards the top of the tree broke, and the ghost, the disembodied, then spoke that you've liberated me just from hearing the sound of the Srimad Bhagavatam from beginning to end. And left. This happened before the sight of all the villagers. When he was in Puri, there was a yogi who had some powers, some Prapti City powers and some other powers, and I forget his name, but he lived outside of Puri in a forested area, and he was claiming that he was Krishna. And he had a brother, and his brother was Balaram. And so they would bring people from Puri to his ashram in the forest, and he would do magic tricks, and people would accept that he was Krishna. And one of his tricks was, he would send his brother to go bring ladies, aristocratic ladies from Puri, to come and join his rasa dance. This is Krishna. And aristocratic men were very unhappy that their wives were being polluted by this so-called Krishna. So they went to the magistrate and said, please do something. So the magistrate, Bhakti Nirtaka, said to the constables, go and arrest him and bring him here for this violation of religious principle. And they said, we're afraid of our families. This man is very powerful, and we cross him, he could make a curse and our families could die. So he's a powerful person. So Bhakti Nirtaka said, I will personally go. You come with me. It's detailed in his biography that's described. He went to his ashram, and the man had long ratted hair as a yogi, and so he had this, one of those magic tricks was he could move his hair, sway it back and forth, and sparks would come from his hair. So he did that. And Bhakti Vinod Thakur said, no, I'm not moved by your tricks. Please tell, I'm asking you a question. Have you done this? Have you brought women here from the city to engage in your so-called rasa dance? Tell me the truth. And the man said, I'm Krishna, I have rasa dance. They said, I want to bring you to trial. And the man said, but I'm Krishna, so how can you bring me to trial? But this is one of my leaders, so I'll go with you. So the constables took him and they put him in jail. And the man was fasting while he was in jail. This went on for nearly a month. Less than a month, 20 days, something like that. And he was making curses that Bhakti Nirtaka's family would die. And his daughter, in the course of the trial, the daughter came down with cholera. And Bhakti Nirtaka's wife was saying, please, please, let the man go. Our family is... But he was unmoved. He continued the whole procedure. It's described that he himself came down with a very intense fever, and on the very day that he was writing from the bench, he was writing the decision, his whole body was trembling. But when he finally made the pronunciation, he was guilty of breaking the law. And then he gave him a sentence of some years in prison or something. Then the first thing he did was have his hair cut, because his powers were stored in his hair. And the yogi died within some number of days. The purpose of the narration is to show that he was fearless. He was a brahmana, but he was, by his disposition, and he was fearless in the execution of his duties. And in the course of his growing, in his interest in Lord Chaitanya's teachings, he desired to get a transfer from Jagannath Puri to Krishna Nagar, which is near where the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is in West Bengal. The government refused. He was doing too good of a job. They refused his transfer. He waited some time and requested once again transfer, and they said no, so he quit. So then they gave him the transfer. That he became a magistrate in the British government in Krishnanagar. Krishnanagar, from the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, was just on the other side of the river Saraswati and the tributaries of the Ganges. And he made his residence at a place called Sinabikunj. He named it like that. It's just at a point where the Saraswati comes in and the Ganges comes in, and on the other side of the river is the city of Navadvip. So he could perch there, he could see the city of Navadvip. He was such an important person that the British made a train track so that he could ride from his home, from his residence, to Krishnanagar. It was also for the villager people. They could go to the marketplace in Krishnanagar and purchase things and go back. But it was for him. Such an important person. When he was there, once while visiting very important event in his life, when visiting in Navadvip, one night on the veranda of a residence where he was staying, a dharmshala where he was staying, he saw on the other side of the Ganges River a tall, towering edifice, glowing at night, radiantly glowing. And there's no edifices over there, it's just rice fields. But when he brought his samyana kit and showed him, and it was seen the next day, this is all recorded in some diary that he kept. So, because he was curious, I could go into detail, I won't. But the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had been lost. The course of the Ganges, after Lord Chaitanya's departure, shifted, as was told in Ananta Samhita, a very old text, that it would happen. The place where Lord Chaitanya's pastimes had taken place were underwater for some time. And then after some time, the Ganges shifted again. Make a long, detailed description short. He discovered the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that edifice that he saw was the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. With British maps and the historical records of where Lord Chaitanya's pastimes were, he went to the place and the local Brahmins said, there's this place where it's useless. We stay here because the farmers won't use it, it won't grow anything, except tulsi. Won't even grow eggplants. So, because tulsis are grown, they don't use it for passing stool even, so it's useless to anybody, so we stay here because there's tulsi. But so Bhaktivinoda Thakur had understood from the various sources that that was the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he brought his spiritual master, Jagannath Das Babaji, who at the time was 120 years old, so old he couldn't walk, so he was carried in a basket. And Jagannath Das Babaji, when he's brought to the place, leaped in the air, literally, and said, this is Lord Chaitanya's birthplace. And he later did some excavation. Although he was such an important person, he went from door to door, asking all gentlemen of Bengal to offer at least 1 rupee for the building of Lord Chaitanya's temple. It was a humble act, but it was a purposeful act also to help people who had thought some other place was Lord Chaitanya's birthplace to accept this. Because because he was doing it personally. Then when they did the excavation, they found in the foundation area a murti, an Hoksaja Vishnu murti. That was the same murti that Jagannath Mishra had worshipped. So what had happened was the Ganges mud had covered layers and layers and layers and was deep underground. When the Ganges moved, it was not just land, but deep under the land was the birthplace of Rajatanya and the deity of Jagannath Mishra. So it's now on the altar. And Rajatanya is the birthplace. More details, but I just won't go into that. I'll just describe the main features of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life was being a visionary. He envisioned, he laid the plan and the foundation for the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam as given by Lord Chaitanya to go throughout the world. He reestablished the credibility of Lord Chaitanya's teachings because at that time the strength of them had been lost. The purity and strength of them had been lost, and he restored that. He discovered the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. He trained his son, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, to become a very powerful acharya. He wrote 120 books for the benefit of the world, and still to this day, you read them and they're very, very profound. And there's a lot of instruction for householders, because he himself was a householder with 10 children. At the same time, he was writing all these books and presenting the teachings of Lord Chaitanya in a very, very wonderful way. So, because of the work that he did in the birthplace of Mahaprabhu in Navadvipa in West Bengal, he was called the seventh Goswami, meaning the immediate followers of Lord Chaitanya, who established the place of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, where they were, and established temples and so on. Bhaktivinoda Thakur did a similar thing in Navadvipa, established the teachings and the places of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes in Navadvipa, entrusted further to Bhakti Siddhanta, his son, to continue with that work. Finally, I'll just say this, that he envisioned this very Adhuta Mandir, majestic, brilliant temple. He researched scripture and found that there was actually a mention in scripture that such a temple will one day be manifest. And Bhakti Siddhanta, his son, repeated that message to Bhakti, that his father had taught like this, and the Ananta Samhita speak like this. So Prabhupada took it upon himself to build that mandir. And he asked one of his disciples, who was the grandson of Henry Ford, Albert Bush Ford, who became his disciple, Ambarish Das, if he would help him. So Ambarish said yes. And there is now a design for that temple that as soon as the West Bengal government gives the permission, the construction will begin, and that it'll be a Prabhupada gave it a very unique name. Temple of Vedic Planetarium. What he wanted, inside there would be the main worship area, but there would be three domes. One of the domes is where the Srinivasa is worship. Another dome is where the main temple area is. Another area is, there's a Vedic Planetarium. And there's a team of about 50 devotees in different areas researching what the Vishnu Purana and Mahabharata and Srimad Bhagavatam and various Vedic scriptures say about the cosmology of the universe. And there's another team that are researching what great teachers and the Sri Sampradaya and Bhakta Sampradaya have taught on this subject. And there's technical literature where there's mathematical calculations like what Bhaktisiddhanta did, but Bhaktisiddhanta was 20 years old, he wrote a book on astronomy with calculations of distances and orbits and so many based upon formulas of Vedic wisdom. So there are teams of people researching all this so that you can have an interfacing with the contemporary authorities in South India today. They're very excited about the project, so it's a multi-million dollar project to have a planetarium that shows, according to the Vedic teaching, what's the structure of the universe. Vedic planetarium. Prabhupada's wish was that persons from all over the world that aren't necessarily interested in Dolce Tenda, but they may be interested in what the Vedas say about the structure of the universe, you know, science. They'll come to see that planetarium. And by seeing the planetarium, they'll come to know who's Dolce Tenda, which connects with the vision of Bhakti Vinod Thakur that the whole world should know about who is Lord Chaitanya and his teaching. So this was Prabhupada's genius, to create a situation where persons from all over the world would come to know who is Lord Chaitanya. In addition to the literature that describes Lord Chaitanya's teachings, bring people who aren't going to read the literature, but they want to, you know, they hear about this fantastic, awesome planetarium, which is just a continuation or a fulfillment of the desire of Bhakti Vinod Thakur. One morning Prabhupada was on a walk in Mayapur describing to the devotees about Bhakti Vinod Thakur, and it was one glory after another glory after another glory, and said, you know, such a powerful acharya. He did so many things, so expertly. The range was so amazing. And then one devotee said to Prabhupada, if Dr. Mahatma had this vision, he was so powerful, why didn't Krishna consciousness go all over the world? He's so powerful. And Prabhupada smiled and said, he gave something for us to do. And then the devotee said, and now you've given something for us to do, which is build this Vedic planetarium temple. Prabhupada said, you've understood very much. So, that temple should be waiting for the government. West Bengal government isn't the most pleasant entity to deal with. The communist government is fading in its popularity, but they still have the ruling party, and not easy to get them to give permission. But once they give permission, the construction will begin, and perhaps in 4 years you can visit Mayapur and visit the Vedic planetarium. Go visit the home where Bhakti Vinod Thakur lived, and across the Saraswati River, very close by. And the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
I seek one clarification from Maharaj.
Okay.
Krishna Sauradhi, 20th incarnation, he was giving Dwapara Yuga. Okay. Prior to that, Kripa Yuga is there and Satya Yuga is there, in which the outer realms are there, Masa Avatara, Kurma Avatara, Vamana Avatara, and again Rama, Parashurama, etc. So now we are telling Krishna in the original Godhead. So, previous to this Dwapara Yuga also, Kripa Yuga is there, Satya Yuga is there, and the Yuga might have been repeated so many times also. But what has Krishna Sauradhi given 5,000 years back? Okay. So how we are drawing Krishna is the Godhead, because Krishna is clearly portion of Mahavishnu Dharma, of Sri Rupa Sai, or Vishnu Sai, like that.
I understand your question. I understand your question.
Yeah.
I'll give it, since you're asking a question in a technical way, I'll give a little technical answer, if that's all right. The reference that you've given is the 22nd avatar is from chapter 3 of Canto 1. Chapter 3 of Canto 1 is an answer to the questions in chapter 1. The sages of Manishwaran have asked you to 6 questions. One of them is, please describe the avatars of the Lord as they appear in this world. So, to answer that question, we give a list. At the end of that list is a very important verse. Eti chamsa kalapam sam krishnas tu bhagavan sayam, which means that out of all of these avatars, one is the source of them all. And Swayam Bhagavan Krishna is the source of them all. Now, how is it, your question is, how is it that it's listed, there's several things you're asking. How is it that he's listed as an avatar of Vishnu? 20th, to be specific. 19 is Balaram and 20 is Krishna. How is it that he's listed as an avatar of Vishnu that is the source of all avatars? Is that not a contradiction? And the answer is no, it's not a contradiction in the following way. Elsewhere, it describes Vishnu as I mentioned this last night, a kala. Kala means a portion of a plenary portion. So the plenary portion is in fullness. The portion of a plenary portion is not in fullness, but it's a plenary portion. The same Srimad Bhagavatam and Sri Brahma Samhita and other sources describe that Mahavishnu expands for the purpose of material creation. He's an expansion of Lord Sankarshan, of the Chaturvyuha in Vaikuntha. Say it again. Mahavishnu, the Purusha avatars, are expansions of Sankarshan of the Chaturvyuha in Vaikuntha. The Purusha Sukta prayers of the Rig Veda also described like that. Vishnu is an expansion of Sankarshan in the spiritual world, in the Vaikuntha realm. So, although this, the position of the list of avatars as they appear in this world, Krishna's 22 in that list, those avatars have their position in the spiritual world before there's even material creation. It's like, say, Ram, for example. At the end of Ram's Leela, what happened? Along with all of his associates, he returned to the spiritual realm. Before coming to this realm, he's in his spiritual realm. He comes to this realm and returns to that realm. So he's appearing as an avatar of Vishnu, but he has his own realm besides, apart from, the whole of creation. He exists eternally before there's even creation. So he appears as the avatar of Vishnu. But he has his position in the spiritual world. So I gave the example of the doorway. We all came in through that door. Did we exist before we came through that door? Yes. And the position of Krishna as an avatar of Vishnu is known by the leelas that he performs. But the queens, excuse me, these are the ladies of Hastinapur, they're describing you exist before that. So in that list, now go back to the Ate Cha Amsa Kala. There's that word Kala again. All these, the word Vishnu is Kala. He's a portion of the plenary portion. The source of them all is Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam. Bhagavan Swayam, Krishna Bhagavan Swayam, he is the source of Vishnu, who is this entryway into this realm of all the avatars. Of all of them, Krishna is the original. Now, the details of what does that, you know, the Sanskrit mean, there's, you know, the endings of the terms. You know, there's the subject and predicate, in other words. And the predicate is what is unknown, so this is a technical answer, and the subject is what is known. So, what's unknown, what's known is that Krishna is an avatar of Vishnu. What's unknown is what's the source of all those avatars. And the verse is saying Krishna is the source of all those avatars. If you like, I can give you the place in the Chaitanya Charitamrita where Krishna Kaviraj Goswami discusses in detail the Sanskrit of that verse. It's a very important verse in Srimad Bhagavatam for the followers of Lord Chaitanya. Our acharyas have given much attention to that verse because it's the basis of making the statement Krishna is the source. It's the Bhagavatam basis, but there's other basis. Right in Rig Veda, right in Purusha Sukta prayers. Purusha is Vishnu, the source of universes, the source of each, the structure within each universe as Garbha Daksha Vishnu, then the details within every atom. That's Vishnu. That's Purusha. The Purusha suktas or prayers growth on Purusha, but they're beginning. Describes those Purushas are expansions of the original personality of Godhead. So who's that original personality of Godhead? The Bhagavatam is identifying as Krishna. Now, one other point, because you want to say something else, but one other point.
If that visual portion is Krishna,
huh? That
visual portion, you are telling that is Krishna.
With the original personality of Godhead, from whom the original personality of Godhead, from whom the plenary portions and the Vishnu expansions, the Kala expansions come, the original personality of Godhead, I don't know, you don't know, but scripture knows, and what scripture says, that's Krishna. Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. Go ahead.
So that Vishnu is Chaturbhuja, and beyond that vision is you are telling Krishna. So why we are not praying that Krishna? Now we are praying only Govardhana Krishna, Radha Krishna.
Okay, that's nice.
If you are telling,
I got your question. The form of Krishna in Vrindavan comes only once. And every day of Brahma. And every day of Brahma, I hope we don't lose everyone's interest because this is technical. But Brahma, in every day of Brahma, there's 1,000 cycles of the four yugas. And the 999 of the 1,000, Krishna appears in Dwarka Yuga as Vasudeva, as you say, Chaturbhuja, Krishna, form Krishna. There's no Vrajaliva. But once, out of his 1,000, he does what we hear in the prison house of Kamsa. He requested Vasudeva and Devaki, take me to Vraja and place me by the side of Nanda Maharaj and Mother Jasoda. So then he can perform his Vrajaliva. That Vraja Kishore Krishna, or Nanda Nandana, or Jasoda Nandana, Vrajendra Nandana, that's the Swami Bhagavan Krishna. The Vasudeva Krishna is his expansion. Found in Vaikuntha. There's a Goloka Vrindavan. This is our, and I give the scriptural references if you like, but this is what scriptures see. There's Goloka Vrindavan, where the pastime that we find in Vraja are performed by Krishna eternally.
So there's something unique about,
unique,
more than unique, in Vaikuntha, as in Dwaraka, Krishna manifests his Aishvarya, his affluences, and fullness. Parashramuni and Vishnu Purana has described it, the six opulences of the Supreme Lord Narayana. His beauty and his knowledge and his renunciation and, you know, the opulences, the Aishvarya Bhagavan. So in Vaikuntha, that opulence and fullness is manifest. But the opulence, it invokes awe and veneration, neutrality, and in the pastimes of Krishna in Vrindavan, the madhurya or the sweetness of Krishna becomes so strong that it covers the opulence. Although Krishna shows his opulence, he lifts Govardhan Hill. Does so many things that show his opulence. He's Bhagavan. But the residents of Vrindavan, they're so moved by the madhurya feature of Krishna, the sweetness feature of Krishna, they don't see him as God. They see him as their darling son, or dearmost friend, or the person who they play with in the pasturing grounds of Vraja. That excels the opulences of Bhagavan. It's a mystery. Because what can excel the opulences of Bhagavan? The sweetness of Krishna. He covers, through his Yogamaya potency, he covers his own identity. So that Mother Jasoda can treat him as her darling boy, and he goes and steals butter, and she comes after him with a stick. When Queen Kunti, she marvels. She also has parental affection. She says, I can't understand. And her parents, I can't understand the love of Mother Jasoda. He who is feared by fear personified is afraid of a little stick in Mother Jasoda's hand, so he cries. He rubs his eyes again and again, and tears are coming from his eyes because he's afraid. If he was just pretending, that's okay, then I can understand. But he's afraid. I don't understand this love of Mother Jasoda. So it's a very deep subject that you're asking a question about. Here's another example. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was once on a tour in South India. And he went to the temple of Sri Rangam. And when the chief priest, Venkatapata, saw the ecstatic love of Lord Chaitanya dancing before Ranganath, he'd never seen anything like that before. So Venkatapata was a grihastha. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was a sannyasi. So he invited the sannyasi, please come to my home and have lunch. And in the course of the exchange, he became so ecstatic, he said, it's now the beginning of the rainy season, please stay here. Be a guest in my home. So Lord Chaitanya agreed to stay for the duration of the 4 months of rainy season. While there, they had many discussions on spiritual topics. Very ecstatic discussion. So one discussion is recorded in detail. Venkatapata asked, the Lord Chaitanya asked Venkatapata, why is it that your Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, being the most chaste, wanted to leave the side of Narayana to go join Krishna's rasa dance? And Venkatapata's reply was, there's no wrong and no lack of chastity on her side, because Narayana and Krishna are the same. And Lord Chaitanya said, very well, but she underwent austerities. Goddess of fortune underwent austerities to enter into the rasa dance, and according to scripture, she wasn't able to enter into the rasa dance. If she's Krishna and Narayana the same, why? Why she's not able to enter into the rasa dance? And Paikata Basa said, I don't know. But I'm sure you know. So can you explain it to me? So Lord Chaitanya explained. There's a mood in Vaikuntha, this Aishwarya mood. And Lakshmi has it because she's worshipping Bhagavan, Narayan, and all of his opulences. But the mood in Vrindavan cannot be entered as long as you're thinking, he's Bhagavan. It's a different mood. And so, in order, it's not by austerities, it's not by position, it's by getting the mercy of the residents of that mood. Those who possess that mood can give one that mood. You can enter into the mystery of Krishna's loving relation in Braja, because this madhurya is the essence of it. But still he's Bhagavan. And so, when describing Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, you can go back and forth. You can say he's Krishna, but he's Bhagavan. Look what he did. At some weeks old, he killed this terrible demon, Putana. And then, et cetera, et cetera. Trinavarta. Shakatasura. Aristasura. Andasura. So many asuras. Powerful demons that were the terror. Anyway, Krishna, they matched their opulences against Krishna, and Krishna defeated them effortlessly. He's just a small boy. But it's gone. And the residents, when they saw, they didn't think, oh, he must be God. They would go back and tell their parents, oh, this wonderful thing Krishna did today. When Nanda Maharaj was taken by the servants of Varuna, because one day was a Dwadasi day, and Nanda Maharaj was breaking the Akadasi fast, so he was first taking his bath in the Ganges, in the sea. It must have been the river Jamuna. Taking his bath in the river Jamuna. It was before, at least the constable thought, it was before the time to take the bath, so he kidnapped Nanda Maharaj and was to disappear. So everyone saw Nanda Maharaj being taken away. So they went, Krishna, Krishna, help! So Krishna Balaram went to the abode of Varuna. And when Varuna saw Krishna and Balaram, he stopped everything, got off his royal seat and worshipped them right in front of Nanda Maharaj. And Nanda Maharaj is going, this is Varuna, he's worshipping my son. What's going on? And prayers glorified Krishna, and Krishna said, well, can I have my father back? Oh, yes, 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 please forgive me. So when they went back to Vrindavan, Nanda Maharaj described to the residents of Vrindavan what happened. I don't understand who my son is. Maybe when Gargamuni gave the name-giving ceremony, he said he would have powers like Narayan. Maybe that's what he meant. So powerful. But his mood of this madhurya was so strong, it just eclipsed. Like Mother Jasoda seen inside the mouth of Krishna. She couldn't. She saw, but she couldn't believe what she saw. I must be seeing things. I better lie down. Something's wrong with me. Get a doctor. They can't see the Aishwarya because of the strength of Madhurya. And that's the super excellence of the original personality of Godhead. He's manifesting all the opulences of Bhagavan, but they're hidden by this wonderful quality of sweetness, and that is the feature of Krishna and Braja. Only once in every day, but the other 999, It's Vasudeva Krishna. What else? It's the same theme with slight variations. The Prabhupada uses the term spool. Like a thread is at a spool. So it's wound and round and round and round and round and round and it just keeps coming back. But the spool of Krishna's pastimes are in theme basically the same. But each time they're performed slightly differently because Prabhupada describes variety is the mother of enjoyment.
We were more only just to present four yugas for us. Present, because the cycle will rotate so many times.
So many times.
Satya yuga, dropa, dresa yuga, dropa, dresa,
yeah.
Satya yuga.
Yeah.
Now presenting we don't only present for perhaps. That is Satya yuga is Satya Hachana, this thing. The dresa yuga is Ramachandra, dropa yuga is Krishna, Kalika, now we are.
Yes, right. But through the agency of Scripture, we can know more than that. Well, if it's all through the agency of Scripture, we know about Satyayuga and Tretayuga and Dwapayuga. Otherwise, we're not pre-covered yet. We rely upon
it. Only one cycle we can be knowing. There may be so many
others. And even one cycle is very limited, what we know.
Because it has been documented only for this.
Yeah. But the scriptures go beyond this four yugas.
But it is not documented.
No, it's documented. It's not that, like in the Bhagavatam, with the Varaha avatar, it's described that there's a Sreta Varaha and a Rakta Varaha, and there are different models. Different models means different.
Sreta Varaha.
So it's different manas, and different manas means different cycles of four yugas. It's not just this cycle of four yugas, that's all that's documented. Swarnabhu Manu is documented. The new number seven, that is what the manu. Rotisha Manu and...
In Hari, Varodha is there, now we are running 28 cycles of this yuga.
Yeah.
So in 28 cycles, there is interpolation between Treta Yuga and Dwapara Yuga.
That's right.
Actually, Dwapara should come first and Treta should
right.
come back.
That's
three.
Right. That's
but
right.
in the 28th cycle, it has taken
that's
an
right.
overnight.
That's right.
And so it came Treta Yuga first
yeah.
and Dwapara
Yuga. That's right. Same
so Treta Yuga took the Dwapara itself, already 27 cycles have been completed.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4.
That's right. So it's 28.
That's
what
you could
understand from the reading of Bible. That's right. That's right.
Okay.
You probably almost get to work. 8:45, almost 9.
How hours is it in the past?
8:45. That's half as fast, huh?
Yes.